I'm Bob D. Trying to learn that. And I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book entitled Alcoholics Anonymous, the ability to remain sponsorable and a persistent and consistent effort in our primary purpose of trying to forget ourselves and devote our lives to helping others. Consequently, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substance since October 31st, 1978. I'm delighted to be here, and I really want to thank the conference committee and for having us out here. And they flew my fiance out here, she's the one that makes me look good. And they flew her out here, which we travel well together, and it's just an amazing thing when that happens. And most of the time she wants to go with me, but we buy the tickets. And we travel well together, and she's a solid, solid member of AA. She sponsors half the women in the state of Nevada, I think. I want to thank my host, Matt. He doesn't know it, but they're in the Hosts Hall of Fame in GSO. They're building a statue of him right now. I want to welcome all the newcomers, glad you're here. Especially the gal that got the book, Bree. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, day one. That's amazing. You know, I imagine you've been some places, church, Amway, Anthony Robbins, a lot of self-help treatment centers. This is different. This is the only place you'll ever find on the planet where they'll give you a standing ovation and a gift for recently burning your life to the ground. I mean, you're not going to get that at the PTA, I'm telling you. Why do we do that? I mean, see, we know things that you don't know. We know what can happen to you here. You don't know yet because it hasn't happened. And we can't tell you exactly what can happen. We just know it's exciting to watch it happen to you. And some of us, it gratifies us. Some of us, it makes everything and all the effort and all the inconvenience of Alcoholics Anonymous worthwhile. You know? When we get to see someone rise up like the phoenix out of the ashes and find the life that was always God's vision of their life. It just wasn't their vision of their life. And they got a new manager, and it's wonderful to watch. It's just amazing. God, there's a lot of golfers here. 30 years ago, friends of mine tried to turn me into a golfer. I wanted to golf with my buddies. And I'm a smart guy, but I got to tell you, when your IQ is lower than your golf score, you got to know this maybe isn't your fit, Bob. And I had a major handicap, which was honesty, because if I wasn't honest, I could have run a 67 every time. But I have a lot of friends who play golf, and they really enjoy it. I have alcoholism. I have a really bad case. And what that makes me is a guy who's spiritually a bit high maintenance. Now, I used to almost resent the fact that there were people in AA that were happy, joyous, and free and didn't do that much. And I used to when I was new. If you were happy, joyous, and free, I just was hoping you'd get in a car wreck on the way home from the meeting, you know? I'm not that way anymore. But we all play the hand we're dealt here. And I'm dealt a large dose of alcoholism. I'm very much like Bill Wilson. without a lot of action in my life, without a lot of 12-step work, I have tendency to be super opinionated and depressed. And I'm depressed because I can see how stupid all of you are. And so when I go to AA and do a lot of AA, you all shape up. So I don't do it for me so much. I do it for you. So you'll all be better versions of yourself. This has been a tough year. There's an energy. I was at a conference in Vegas in December, and man, the energy in the room, much like the energy in this room. And it's the energy of people that are enthusiastically rejoicing coming out of the darkness and being together again. Because that's our nature. You know, historically, even during wars, even in countries where you could be put in prison for going to AA, AA existed there underground. Because alcoholism is a dominant force here. And if you're new here, my great hope for you is that you don't underestimate alcoholism and you don't overestimate yourself. And if you can stay humble enough to know that you need this and do the things that the people here do, and it's not a mystery, really. It's just like, it's like a spiritual conga line. You just get behind the guy in front of you that's sober longer, and when he shakes his butt to the right, you shake your butt to the right. When he shakes it to the left, you shake it to the left. It's monkey see, monkey do. And it's not rocket scientists. It's just find the people that are sober a long time and they seem truly free. And they laugh a lot. And hook up with them. Follow them. Go where they go. Over 2,000 years ago, there was a guy who died. His name was Lazarus. And this carpenter and his followers were traveling around the country. And they found Lazarus dead. And I don't know what the carpenter did or said, but he did it and said something. And all of a sudden, Lazarus is back alive again. He was so amazed. He said, "My God, I was dead. This is amazing." And he said to one of the carpenter's followers, "What do I do?" And he said, "Just go around and tell everybody what happened to you." In 1978, I tried to take my own life. And some grace I didn't even believe in came into my life in a moment of surrender and desperation, hopeless desperation. And so I spent the last 43 years trying to basically just tell people what happened to me, you know? And I'm not a special case here. It happens to all of us to some degree. But we reaffirm each other's experience. When I tell you about my surrender, you remember yours. And that's very important. I almost died of this disease because I don't want to be an alcoholic. In the beginning of the third chapter, it says most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. I do not want to be an alcoholic. I'm good with being other stuff. I'll be a drug addict. That's a little sexy panache to that. I mean, I had rock star heroes that were professed drug addicts. I'm willing to be that. I'll be a mental health case, because if you're a mental health case, you get pills and sympathy. I like both of those. But I don't want to be an alcoholic. There's nobody I ever looked up to that wet their pants regularly. You know, alcoholism, to me, is pathetic and lame and, oh, bad. It's not good. It's not good. But I am an alcoholic. And people who argue with the truth get sick. And I went to amazing lengths to argue with myself and anyone I needed to argue with about how I'm not really an alcoholic. And I don't know. It seems like my ego was hell-bent when I was forced to come to AA meetings to find the differences between me and you. I'd pick you apart. I'd find the differences. And we get sicker on the differences and we get better on the similarities. But when you have the mind I got, I can't see the similarities. But man, can I see the differences? And it doesn't take much to... And my alcoholism, this thing that's killing me, I can't see it. Because it hides in the middle of a whole bunch of other problems. And there's a... Marnie and I over... Earlier this year, we spent a month over... Actually, longer than that. Over in Maui. And in the center of Lahaina, there's this tree that's like takes up a whole city block. And it's one of the largest banyan trees anywhere. And this it looks like a forest. But it's not. It's one tree. But it's a lot of trunks and a lot of branches coming off those trunks. But if you trace it all back, there's one trunk in the center and it all comes from that. And that's the way my alcoholism, it hid from me in a forest, in a menagerie of other problems that some of them seem more severe. Like, I used heroin. See, my case is different. I did speed. Yeah. See, my case is different. I'm a depressive. See, my case is different. I don't feel like you people in AA look or sound. You see, my case is different. You guys, some of you came from horrible families that explained why you were so weird and screwed up. I came from a family burdened by love. Oh my God. You think that would make it better? It doesn't make it better. Now I have nothing to hang out my weirdness on. I would sit and envy. I had a friend whose dad was a in and out of prison, covered with prison tattoos. He'd get out of prison for a month before he'd get back in there and beat everybody up. Everybody was afraid of him. But that is a dad you could respect. The people that go to work every day and pay their bills and, oh, square, square, square. Oh, my God, I was embarrassed by my dad. He was a good guy. Isn't it funny, no matter where you come from, it's not quite right, is it? The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. Whether you come from a terrible home, like many guys I sponsor, I sponsor guys that have childhoods that are like bad episodes of Criminal Minds. And then I know sponsor guys that had childhoods like me that were given opportunities and a lot of love and nurturing. And we all have the same sickness that rose out of us in our lives, regardless of any of that. We all end up feeling that what Wilson refers to is that feeling of anxious apartness. I've had that all my life. I had it in school. I had it in my family even. And like holidays when everybody gets together. A feeling like it's all of you and then there's me. As if there was some invisible and yet impenetrable barrier between me and life. And I couldn't get through. And I, like a little kid who's stuck at home and he can't go out and play with his nose pressed up against the window watching everybody run around outside and laugh and having a good time. And here I am. On the other side of this invisible yet impenetrable barrier, and I can't get through it until I was 13 years old. I was almost 13 and I was hanging around. I'm going through a lot of gyrations to treat my alcoholism before I ever pick up a drink. Because I'm an alcoholic. I haven't found alcohol yet, but I found the ick. I got the ick. And so I'm doing crazy stuff to fit, to be okay. I'm hanging around, almost 13 years old, I'm hanging around with... These are the tough kids in the town I lived in. These are the kids that are in and out of juvie. These are the kids that when they walked into a junior high school dance, the other kids got out of the way. Oh, I want what they have. I'm tired of being afraid all the time. I'm tired of looking at all the popular kids and yearning to be a part of them. I want people to be a part of me. And these guys, they had something going on. And I was hanging out with them and we pulled a little burglary in the neighborhood. And one of the things we stole was some bottles of whiskey. I didn't know nothing about it. I never saw my parents drunk. I never saw anybody drunk. I don't even know if I understood that it got you high. I don't even think I put that together yet. And I drank my first alcohol. It was the first time that the alcoholism was touched by alcohol. A day that truly would change the course of my life. And I remember some stuff that happened to me. And I'm an alcoholic for two reasons. One is alcohol does something for me. In spite of all the other problems and all the other drugs, and alcohol does something for me that it only does for alcoholics. And what is that? Well, when I was with those older kids that let me come out and play, I didn't have to pretend I was okay and cool and tough anymore. I really was. I was everything I secretly yearned to be. When I was half drunk, I became those things. And I loved it. It set me free. It allowed me to come out and play. It was amazing. Now, what I understand today is what it did is it relieved me of the bondage of self. See, my problem is I just got me and my fears and my anxieties and my shame and my guilt and my just anxiety over the future. Oh, man, I always had anxiety over the future. Did you ever sit and check your future and have it look good? I mean, it never looks good to me. I check it and see problems. I see problems. And so I get me right on me like that creature in that movie Alien that attaches itself to your face.
How are you doing, Bob?
And I have massive feelings of separation, which my sponsor who died a year and a half ago, his sponsor, Chuck, used to say there was one problem that contained all problems, and that's conscious and unconscious separation. And I had those feelings of anxious apartness and the separation before I ever picked up a drink. And I drank and they went away. I drank and I felt connected. And drinking was spectacular. It did something for me that it only does for alcoholics. And I loved the effect produced by alcohol. I lived for the effect produced by alcohol. It was amazing. It's amazing. I mean, who knew that I could, with a pint of 151 rum and some Coca-Cola, that in that pint of 151 was like 45 Arthur Murray dance lessons. I didn't know that. Oh my God, I could go to a dance and I could dance. I didn't know I could dance. I can't dance. You get me half drunk, the rhythm of the universe flows through me. I'm kind of a mopey kid. You get me half drunk, I'm funny. I crack me up, I'm funny. I'm deep. Deep. Remember 3 a.m. smoking a little reefer, drinking wine, cracking the secrets of the universe, you know. Seeing what Buddha saw, you know. And I'll tell you, I don't want to be crude, but it's the truth. If it wasn't for alcohol, I'd probably be celibate to this day. Because I was so hyper self-sensitive and so afraid of rejection. And those of you that know what it feels like to be afraid of rejection, you know what we do? We reject ourselves. Right? There's a loneliness encompassed in that fear. I found alcohol and the fear went away and I could talk to girls and I could dance and I was the guy I yearned to be. And I didn't even know what I yearned for until I found it. It's like you don't know that you don't really feel that good until you finally feel good. And I wanted to feel that way the rest of my life and I tried. But I got alcoholism and so what that means is when I start drinking, I have the single definitive characteristic of alcoholics. Is that when I drink alcohol, I can't stop. And because I can't stop and I don't know that I can't stop. I burn my life to the ground time and time and time again. And I always go too far. I don't stop when I'm drunk. I mean, when people get drunk, they stop. Not me. I don't stop as long as I'm conscious. I'm that guy. So I start getting in a lot of trouble because I got this allergy to alcohol. I don't know it. I remember one time, any blackout drinkers in here? Oh. Hard going through life when other people know more about you than you do, isn't it? Yeah, I'm telling you. I don't know about you, but I never heard anything good the next day. Oh, I hear you peed in our kitchen, for God's sakes. You know, I hear that kind. I hear shameful, horrible stuff that I can't believe. I didn't do that. Yes, you did. They didn't have Photoshop then, because if you would have taken a picture of me doing it, I would have said it's Photoshop. It's not me. It's not me. But it was me. I do weird things when I drank, and things I was ashamed of. And so I had a morning. I used to have a lot of mornings like this, but this was a bad one. You know, where the night before, I got really out there. And I did some shameful, embarrassing things. Now there's a whole group of people. I can't even go around. I'm so ashamed of myself. And my roommate, I don't know if he's an alcoholic or not, but I'll tell you, he loves to tell me the stuff I did the night before that I don't remember. He loves that. And it's horrible, and I'm scared, and I'm remorseful, I'm embarrassed, I'm humiliated, and I'm scared. And I just, having this conversation with myself, man, I can't do that again. I could have went to jail. This is horrible. I'm supposed to meet my buddies down at Dots, Dot Bilski's. It's a little corner bar where we shoot pool and drink. Man, I can't go down there and do that again. But I'm nervous. I come to him, I shake a little bit, you know. And I need to calm my nerves down a little bit. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? I can't do what I did last night. And I thought, oh, I know what I'll do. I come up with brilliant plans. The plan is I'm only going to have 8 drinks. Just 8. That's it. No more, no less. 8 drinks, that's it. I'll slow sip them. It's going to be good. I never punched a cop on 8 drinks. I never did anything too humiliating on 8 drinks. That's always somewhere north of 12, you know. 8 drinks. So I go there with a plan, and my buddies are there. We're shooting pool, and I'm not a slow sipper, though. I can't do it. When I start to drink, I'm like the Alpo dog in the commercial that they haven't fed for 3 weeks. You know, I'm that guy. So I'm enjoying the plan. I'm having fun. I'm laughing. I'm shooting pool with my buddies. And it's a great plan. And then I hit 7. When you hit 7, it's like an epiphany about what a terrible number 8 is. You know what I mean? It's a stupid number. What was I thinking? That was retarded. What am I thinking? 8? No. 10. 10's a good number. Till you get to 9. And I just keep moving the line. And I don't know that that's an abnormal reaction to alcohol. Because it doesn't look like a phenomenon of craving. To me, it looks like I changed my mind. I got new information. And alcoholism with the use of alcohol punked me out. And I don't even know what's happening to me. It's the only disease I know of. If you've got it, it uses your own mind against you. Which is not good, because that's a terrible thing. Because when I'm afraid, when I'm frustrated, when I'm resentful, you know what I like to do? Think. So I'm returning to the source of my demise for guidance, is what I'm doing. That's insane. I'd be better off getting a guy like Jeffrey Dahmer as a spiritual advisor or something, you know. I started 8 better. Never said that before, never will again. I got this phenomenon of craving. And then there's another aspect of alcoholism which almost killed me. And I suspect the phenomenon of craving and this abnormal reaction to alcohol that you may not even want to believe you have, coupled with the thing I'm going to talk about next, is what kills people like me. See, it's not just that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I have an abnormal reaction to abstinence. And I don't understand it because it's subtle and it's vague and I can't put my finger on it. But after a time, you know, when I first get sober, I'm full of enthusiasm. You know, I'm the guy that's going to, I'm not going to ever drink again. I'm going to change my life. I'm going to go to college. I'm going to get there. I'm going to get a girl. I'm going to jog. I'm like a car engine that won't turn over. I'm going to get drunk is what I'm going to do. And I don't know I'm going to get drunk because I had such a horrible drunk and I swore to myself and I meant it. I'm never touching that stuff again. And then this thing starts happening to me day in and day out. And I, Silkworth says that we become, after a time, restless. I don't know that it's restless. I just have this inability to feel settled anywhere, you know. Did you ever watch a dog circle the living room looking for its spot to lie down? I'm a dog that can't find its spot. I'm irritable, but I don't want to be irritable. I don't like irritable people. I don't want to be irritable, but I am very bright and I can see the stupidity in people quickly. And I'm chronically malcontent. And you know, the funny thing, if you have this unrecognized, unrealized vacancy in you, which I believe is a God hole. But if you got that, you don't know what it is. But it looks like various things. Sometimes it looks like a woman-shaped hole. That's what I need. Or a Harley Davidson-shaped hole. Or a band-shaped hole. Get it in a band, you know, or something. But, you know, what happens is you'll get what you think will make the difference. And the shine wears off of it very quickly. And why am I so chronically disappointed and chronically dissatisfied? I think, no way to prove this, but I think unconsciously on an emotional level, I start lining up what it feels like to have that job to what it felt like to drink a pint of Jack Daniels. Now the job just, you know, it's like, this job ain't no good. I start comparing what it feels like to be in this new relationship to what it felt like to drink a pint of tequila. Now, not only am I disappointed, it's kind of, my life starts to become her fault. Right? And my dissatisfaction and need depended on something or someone. Whatever I brought into my life, our book says that we eventually will succumb to the desire to drink again because of the restless, the irritable, and the chronic malcontent. We will eventually succumb to that because we're seeking ease and comfort that we'd once found that we can't get anymore. So I'm an ease and comfort junkie, looking for ease and comfort. And you know, there's people, I watch this a lot, people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and they're not here for recovery, they're here for ease and comfort. They're here to feel better. AA is a self-help program, and it's not. It's a program of self-abandonment and service. And yet, if you come here and you stay a taker, I don't know, you're not going to get anything. I mean, well, what do you got? What can you get here if it's a taker? Alcoholism, that's all we got, really. You can have all that you want. Because it's in the taking that you exasperate and increase your selfishness and your self-centeredness, which our book says is the root of our troubles. So, In the years from 1971, when I went to my first meeting, to 1978, I was in and out of AA a lot. Most of the time, I didn't really want to go. It was a condition of the treatment center, or the, you know, or it was the only thing interesting to do in the county jail. And so I went to a lot of meetings, but I didn't get nothing here. I didn't understand what was going on. You people, it's funny. Whatever I don't understand, in those days, I had a hard time with anybody that looked like they were doing better than I was. I would have to tear you down. Right? If you were happier, more successful, had a girlfriend, and I did anything, if whatever you had that I didn't have, I would be angry at you for that. Now, I don't want to say that because you look stupid if you say that. But I'd resent you and I'd tear you apart. And everyone in AA appeared to be doing better than me. So I don't really fit here. I'm not one of your happy, clappy do-gooders. People that are grateful for everything. I'm not like that. I hate myself. I hate my life. I'm not grateful for anything. Is it any wonder that I hate myself? I mean, for God's sakes, objectively, this may be true for some of you. If someone else would have done to my family, loved ones, and the people that were important to me and the opportunities in my life that I did to those things and people, I'd want to kill them. So is it any wonder that I secretly hate myself? And I'll tell you, it's pretty hard to save your own life when you secretly hate yourself. And thank God for the amends process and the whole encouragement to be a part of an altruistic movement that is Alcoholics Anonymous, a program of self-abandonment and service. And as I help you, I don't know that indirectly I'm helping me. As I make amends to you, I'm changing the way I feel about me. I didn't know that. I'm just doing what my sponsor told me to do. So in 1978, I was sentenced to 2 years in a state penitentiary. And then the judge cut me a break and pushed the commitment aside and told me if I went into this place in Pittsburgh called the Ark House, and if I stayed in there a year. I hate to even call the Ark House a treatment center. It was the bottom of the food chain for treatment centers. I mean, it was like a bunch of homeless guys and guys right out of prison. There's guys here from Pittsburgh. I saw them earlier. And I went into this place, and I went in there with a determination, because I don't want to do the 2 years. And I'm made up my mind this time. I know I said that before, but I really mean it this time. I am not going to drink again. I got too much at risk. And it's not fun anymore either. And so I'm not going to drink. And the day comes, you know, it always comes. If you are an alcoholic and all you've done is quit drinking and visit a few meetings to see what's wrong with us, which is my favorite way to do it, and you're just doing that, the question isn't if you're going to drink again. I think truly the question becomes when. I think it's an inevitability. Whether it happens to you at 15 years sober, 15 months sober, 15 weeks sober. I've been going to a detox several times. I go to several detox meetings a week. I see all kinds of people drink again. Man, over the pandemic, we had a lot of people take their own lives. We had a lot of people drink again with long-time sobriety because alcoholism is unforgiving. And so I'm in this place, this Ark House, and I'm trying not to drink because, for God's sakes, it's not only isn't any fun anymore, it's turned on me, but I don't jail well. I don't want to do that. You know, I really don't. I don't jail well. And so I'm really pretty serious about this not drinking thing. I mean, and so I'm in there and time goes by and I just get to a place where I'm so lonely. and so depressed, and I feel so useless, and I'm so unfree and unhappy. I am the antithesis of all the promises in the big book. I'm the opposite. And I don't know, I just know that I can't take this much more. And I drank and ended up on the streets. Got caught right away. Because when I start drinking, I have this tendency to want to counsel the counselors. Yeah, I know. I have a big mouth. And so I'm out on the streets and I'm a mess. I don't even know how long. I've never been able to piece it together. I don't know if I'd been on this run after I left there for a week, 2 weeks, 10 days. I don't know, but it was long enough that I'm just drinking round the clock and I'm sick. And I remember one day into this a while, I come to I'm on this park bench in the across from Allegheny General Hospital at this little park, and I'm so sick, and I'm sitting on this bench and I'm grabbing myself and I'm rocking back and forth like I feel like I want to jump out of my skin. My nerves are shot. I tremble like, oh, I can't. Oh, this is horrible. I hate myself. And I know that this is the best drinking is ever going to be for me again, is this pathetic, depressing, lonely, horrible drinking. And I'll tell you, it's like a trap you can't spring and get free of when drinking, the only thing that you ever knew that set you free, is turned on you, and now it's stopped doing something for you and is doing something horrible to you. And now, when I drink, I cry sometimes. I drink into horrible, horrible depression and loneliness, and I don't know what's wrong with me. And I've thrown so many drugs in the mix, trying to fix the drinking end of the equation, and failed. Find a new drug, it's like, oh, this is it. For a week, you know. And I went to therapy with some great therapists. I took medication, did a lot of stuff trying to fix the abstinence end of the equation. Because if I could fix that, I wouldn't have to return to the madness. If I could somehow get happy, sober, I'd be okay. And the harder I try to make myself happy, the more unhappy I seem to become. The book talks about I'm a victim of a delusion that I can rest, and it's with a W, like wrestle. That I can rest happiness and satisfaction on this world if I only manage well. Well, the reason that's a delusion, for God's sakes, who on the planet as a demographic other than us has spent more money, more time, more energy, more obsessive focus on making themselves happy and satisfied as we have? And the end result is I'm going to a bridge to take my own life. You know? And I'm not awake to even understand the dynamic of that, the cause and effect. And I couldn't kill myself, and I ended up through a bizarre series of circumstances in a treatment center in Las Vegas, Nevada, detox. Wasn't trying to go to Vegas. Matter of fact, when I was in Gateway or Mika's House or any of those places in Pennsylvania, if they'd asked me, hey, Bob, we suspect, if you don't die, we think you're going to get sober one day. Why don't you make a list of 100 cities that may occur in? Vegas isn't on that list. I'm telling you, no chance. But I was brought to Vegas by divine appointment. And met a man in there who, God, he laughed a lot. I think that's what attracted me. You know, he laughed a lot later after I asked him to sponsor me. He laughed a lot at my expense. Oh, my God, he just thought my problems were hilarious. You know, there's an adage in AA that I do not think is true. It says, let us love you until you can love yourself. Stop it. I'm the black hole of love. You can't love me enough. If love would have fixed me, my mother and father would have fixed me. Some of my girlfriends would have fixed me. You can love me and sacrifice and give me everything you got, and I'll just stand there and go, is that it? But what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous was more along the lines of, let us laugh at you until you can finally laugh at yourself. And in the humor is the humility. They came from the same root word. In the humor is the freedom. In the laughter is the connection. I think sometimes in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, when everybody's laughing, it's like if you close your eyes and just try to feel from the pit of your stomach, you'll hear the voice of God in the laughter. It's the voice of freedom. And we laugh a lot in AA. And we laugh about stuff that, I love it when some Al-Anon, new Al-Anon, or somebody in AA's parents are at a meeting, and we're laughing about stuff that they think is horrible. Yeah, I peed on the Christmas tree and then pawned all the presents. Yeah. You know. The Al-Anons are getting mad, right? Woo. But, you know, we can laugh because we're free. If you can't laugh, you're not free. And that's, now that promise isn't promised us until after step 9. But it happens, doesn't it? Before you're halfway through. Maybe you haven't made all your amends, but you've made enough that you've been lifting yourself off yourself and you're starting to get free. Right? Every time I made an amends, it was like cutting a sandbag off the side of a hot air balloon. After the amends, it's like, oh, man, I think things that you probably think. Why did I wait so long to do that? That's true for the amends that pop up in the nightly review in step 11 or in step 10. And it says that we make amends at once. Well, if it's embarrassing, that could be 3 months. I mean, and I learned through pain. I learned a lot through pain and discomfort. I learned that when I delay doing what I'm supposed to do and making amends, that I will suffer in the interim. And you know how you know that? Because the minute you make the amends, you get the lift and the suffering stops. The moment I do. It's another of an endless series of surrenders. My grand sponsor used to talk a lot about surrender, and I think that's a big piece of what happens or has to happen here. No, I don't think any of us surrender once and for all because of the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego, but we surrender and then we start running the universe, and then we surrender because it's painful to do that, and then you start running the universe again, and this time I'm really going to surrender and I'm never going to take it back, and I'm not the My God, you guys are. I can see it. And I suffer from that. And so what started happening to me in my recovery, I started to realize how wrong I'd been about so many, many things. And I'm wrong about stuff. I got something going on with Marty and I right now, and I'm wrong about it, and I know I'm wrong about it, and it's my dragon to slay. And I have to make this right with inside myself. And I'm probably going to have God's help. And it's never ending. I mean, there's no end to the things I have to correct. There's no end to it. Because my ego and self-centeredness hasn't gone completely away. So it's reoccurring. And I had this sponsor who, my God, he was such a, he'd been a delegate. He had one of the guys that started the Las Vegas Roundup. He was involved in that, the starting of the first men's nonprofit, which there are not many nonprofit recovery houses left. It's like big money now. But it's a nonprofit. First nonprofit. I lived there in my early sobriety because I had nowhere to go. I was homeless. He was involved he had service positions. He was involved in everything. So I didn't know that, or I might have found a different sponsor. Because he wants me to do everything he's done. Right? General service, intergroup service, H&I. I was a week out of detox. And he starts hammering me about being one of the guys taking the panel into the detox to share. He wanted me to get on the 12-step list. He wanted me to go out with old timers and go help people, go try to get them sober. He wanted me to do service. Help, 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 help. I'm Jesus. What a do-gooder. Oh, my God. So because of my extensive therapeutic background, I said, well, you know, I understand what you're saying. But don't you think I should work on me for a while? And he looked like he bit into a lemon and he reared back and work on you. You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. And when he said, I didn't get my feelings hurt. I just thought, yeah, that's right. I mean, if I could have been fixed, I'd have been fixed by now. I mean, I was hypnotized. I did rational emotive therapy. I did transactional analysis, gestalt therapy, primal screened. I mean, Jesus. If I could have been helped, I'd have been helped by now. My parents spent a fortune on treatment and psychiatry. Oh, my God. It's unbelievable. And I'll tell you how sick I am. I never even thanked them. My ego has a lot of entitlement and a lot of dissatisfaction. That I was so selfish and so self-consumed and that I would not even acknowledge the many, many people that tried to love me and help me. Never. Because it never was really enough. Yeah, you say you love me. But you don't really love me the right way. I don't know what the right way is, but it isn't this, evidently. Or else I think I'd feel better. So he gets me doing 12-step work, and it's like he's pushing me into this. And my light started to come on. I started having these little experiences that were where I'm helping. I'm spending an evening, 4, 5, 6 hours with some guy who's coming apart. And I walk away from that and I'm internally rearranged. Now I may go back to being the way I was, but for a time, it's almost like, and I started realizing and that this is something I got to do every day. Wilson says it. He says our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others, their needs, how we can work for them. That a kindly act once in a while will not suffice. We have to act a good Samaritan every day. Every day. And what I realized is I spent most of the evening with that guy. It lit me up. I loved the way I felt. But now it's the next morning and I don't feel so good. You know, when I was drinking the next morning, I knew what to do. You got to go re-up. You got to re-up. The bottle I drank last night isn't going to help me today. And so the altruistic actions on my primary purpose that I did yesterday aren't going to help me today. This is a whole new day. And that was, I'll tell you, that truly, that was one of the hardest things, very hard for me during the pandemic. Because we were shut down for a period of time, and I had to get creative. I started answering the phones for central office. Took a little bit of me off of me. I sponsored a lot of guys. We'd have them in our backyard. We had a meeting out in the backyard. Take a little bit of me off of me. Because my alcoholism is relentless and unforgiving. And I think some of us die or drink again because we fill up with ourselves. And you know what that's like? When I'm full of me, I'm separate from you. And I think the separation is your fault because you're cliquey and stupid and you don't like me. And if I just suspect you don't like me, I'm going to not like you first. I've had great sponsorship. I would go in early sobriety. When I say early sobriety, I mean my first few years. I would go to my sponsor, and I'm like nuts. I am crazy. I feel like I'm having a nervous breakdown from anxiety. Because I'm a collector of resentments and fears. I save them. They're precious to me. The book uses the term, we shouldn't harbor these things. Oh, like a safe harbor. Yeah, just knock the barnacles off. Safe. And so I'm a collector. I save them because I don't want to go to my sponsor with just one fear or one resentment. He'd think something's wrong with me. So I wait till I have a whole bushel. And I go in there and I dump them on his desk. He never really sees these things correctly. He would say, I don't know. He would say some things I don't understand at first. It took me a while. He'd say, well, you got to stop playing God. I think, I don't say this because I don't want an argument, but I'm not playing God. I'm reporting accurate information here. Isn't it odd that I trust my opinions, my thoughts, my perception, and my thinking more than I'll trust my sponsor, more than I'll trust some ethereal thing I can't put my finger on called God? I trust. It's not that God won't help me. It's I trust my head too much. And I think guys like me and a lot of people I sponsor, I think we have to suffer our way away from that. Why do you eventually want to trust God and stop trusting yourself? Because it's too painful when I follow my own direction. I got to get my life out of the hands of the idiot. I have sponsorship that just tells me, my sponsor, I feel like Chicken Little, the sky's falling. It's so horrible. And he'd always say, yeah, I know. But right this moment, right now, right this moment, is everything okay? Well, yeah, right this moment, but I'll tell you, I'm going to lose my job, and then by the end of the month, I'm not going to have a place to live. But right this moment, is everything all right? And eventually, he'd keep hammering me until I'd have to concede, yes, right this moment, everything's all right. He'd say, good, good, good. When it's no longer okay right now, we got something to work with here. But let's stop trying to solve problems that haven't occurred yet and stop clearing up the wreckage of your future. And he wants to bring me to the great reality of God, which is right here, right now. The fourth dimension, right here, right now. But I'm not a right here, right now guy. I'll do a drive-by in the present once in a while. You know what I mean? You know, all right, done, good. Check the box. Yep, I was in God's presence for a microsecond. But the more he encouraged me to trust this thing, to trust the universe, first of all, and then to trust him and to trust God, the more I took the actions of trust, I started to discover something that has kept me in good stead now for decades. God really is trustworthy. But you don't know that at a gut level until you have trusted him through your actions for a sustained period of time. And the more I take the actions of trusting God, the more trustworthy he becomes. And the more I distrust this, Because this, my head, it's like a problem-seeking missile. It just is fueled by fear and just in angst and, oh my God, it's not good. And what I discovered is that I've been wrong about a lot. How many times have I been afraid the sky's falling? How many times that I've been terrified? And my sponsor gets me to stop taking actions as if that's true and start taking actions as if God's got my back. And what I discover is He did. He did have my back. It really was okay. And over the years, I've come to think that maybe what Chuck said, that the difference between heaven and hell is the glasses you look through. Maybe heaven truly is just a new pair of glasses. Maybe that this creates the hell, and this creates the problems. What if you look back and you realize you have had problems in your life continually as far back as you can remember? What if you discovered a truth that they never existed? And the only time that the things you were afraid were going to happen actually happened is when you got in there and monkeyed with it and did what psychologists call self-fulfilling prophecies. You made the stuff come true just so you could be right about it. What if you discovered that if you took your hands off your life and really, truly showed up every day as if God's got it? What if you found out that maybe this is still the Garden of Eden? I just never knew it. What if what Dr. Paul used to say this a lot when he would talk. He'd say, I'm surprised how, when I'm out helping somebody, how my problems in my distraction will die of neglect. What if they never existed? What if they never existed? What if happy, joyous, and free is the divine right that's given to me in my creation? It was always me. It was always my inheritance. Unfortunately, I got a head on board that just worries. My head believes that it has to create fears and problems because it's terrified that if it doesn't have a problem to worry about and a situation to solve, that it will have nothing to do. It will recede into obscurity and become nothing. My ego hates that idea. You ever just been sitting? Everything's, there's no problems. One of those little periods where there really is not a problem anywhere. It's life is good right now. And you start thinking. Yeah, it seems like it's good. This is that denial they talk about. You know, God's probably setting me up. He's letting me feel good so I'll take my guard back. The rug's about to be pulled out from under me. I know it. How many times did that happen? Do you ever sit and ponder your life and spiral upward? I don't. I'll sit and ponder my life, and I just, if I'm going to do that, I better not have any sharp objects around. You know what I'm saying? I want to let out some tired blood. Because my ego has to scare me to control me. Driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion. Self-seeking. Self-pity. Driven. And I know what it's... I got sober. I was a type A personality. I don't think I'm so much that anymore. I have a lot of moments and times and sustained periods where I don't worry too much. I mean, You know what I worry about today more than anything? It's indirectly has to do with me. I worry about how happy Marnie is. I want her to be okay. I want her to be happy. And she is. And if she isn't, well, if I could help, I will. But it's usually we all have to fill our own vacancies. We all have to slay our own dragons. Doesn't mean you don't support someone, you don't love them. But I know I have to slay my own dragons. Me and God. And so, I started to realize that this thing called life is so much different. You know, when I got sober, everybody I ever knew was just untrustworthy and intolerant. And nobody tried to understand me. And they were mean. And oh my God, they were unaccepting. And I do my first legitimate four step using the process and resentment in the big book, and I came out the backside with a whole new world. Because I realized how wrong I'd been about everything. My mother. The Buddhists tell stories that depict what they feel is enlightenment. And one of their stories is, it shows that a stage of enlightenment is when you evolve spiritually to a point where you know the most important thing you'll ever know, and that is that you don't know. That you don't know. What would I be like if I really surrendered my will, which is what I want, it's my opinions, it's my perception, my judgments. What if I gave that up? Then there's nothing to worry about here. This is just, oh my God, God's written the most amazing romantic comedy ever written here, and it's my job to laugh and love. It's not my job to direct. It's not my job to worry about whether you didn't do your part right. It's just my job to observe opinionless, willless, opinionless. I think that's heaven. And so, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm very active. I go to a lot of meetings. Not because I can get up here and tell you that. I'm just still 43 years sober. I'm just a better version of me when I'm with you than I am when I'm alone with me. I've always been a better version of me in AA, especially when I'm doing service. I've gone over the years, I've done so many, lots and lots of H&I meetings. I've had mornings. I did 12:30 noon meetings at a Skid Row detox for years and years, 5 days a week. I've had mornings where I felt like I was having a nervous breakdown because things are going wrong at work, and it's like 6-7 figures wrong, and I'm scared. And I go down to that detox, and I don't even know. I can't explain what happens to me, but I come out of there, and my problems are. It's like putting preparation H on your problems. They just shrink. I mean, it's you know what I mean? It's like I come out of there and I'm problem free. How'd you do that? Because I can't do that. And what happened is I got relieved a little bit of the bondage of self, and in that I got free from me. And so I want to again welcome the people that are new. I'm glad you're here. I want to tell you a little story, and I'll end with this. When I was about maybe 9 years sober, the first time I ever got asked to go somewhere out of state and speak, and it was just not very far. It was up in Northern California, a place called Eureka. I'd never been up there. And I went up there, and I had a day, and I was over. I wasn't leaving. This was a Friday night talk, and I had all day Saturday, and I was flying out back home Sunday morning. And I got this guy who's driving me around, and he's really a nice guy, and he takes me to a place called the Avenue of the Giants, where they had these 250-foot trees. Some of them were 25 feet in diameter. I'd never seen anything like it. It was like Jurassic Park. It was amazing. We stayed there for a while, and then he said, come on, I want to take you down to the ocean. There's some amazing-looking cliffs and these rock monoliths that come up out of the ocean. And I said, okay. So we had a little bit of a drive. And we're driving, and as we're going by these meadows and fields. And he said to me, do you notice how you don't see a 200-foot tree all by itself in a field? I said, yeah. He said, you know why that is? I said, I don't. He said, well, God's created those trees that their nature is such that they aspire to grow to such magnificent heights that if they try to grow up alone in a field, they will literally outgrow their roots' capacity to support and hold them up, and they'll topple over and die on their own aspired magnificence. What must happen is that they must grow up in community. And they intertwine their roots into a net below the floor of the forest. And they feed each other and support each other. And that allows them to grow into their nature. That's exactly what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that when I came to AA and I got a home group and a sponsor and I started sponsoring people and having commitments and serving, I had no idea that I was literally intertwining the roots of my new life with yours. And you've allowed me to grow into God's vision of Bob. And it's still occurring. And I got to tell you, truly, 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 God's vision of Bob is much better than my most exaggerated vision of Bob. God can, I can't. For God's sakes, I better let him. Thanks for listening.